Well, we're in the last few pages of the 18th chapter in the Life Divine, Mind and Supermind. And Sri Aurobindo had been describing how it is that avidya comes into being. Avidya, the Sanskrit term for ignorance. It results from the mind's exclusive concentration into itself, from its own standpoint, viewing all others, forgetting its interdependence and interrelationship with all other beings, forgetting its essential oneness with that which exceeds all definition and all formulation. It's embedded in the moment. It's married to a form. And in that exclusivity, it has lost its power of unity, except as it strives to aggregate, to reassemble, but never can it do more than construct a model of what that is. So, in this cardinal error that the mind makes, comes the whole chain of consequences which follow upon the step into ignorance, ignoring oneself. So now we begin with this sentence, how ignorance comes to worsen the situation. This ignorance, he writes, is farther deepened for man by his self-identification with the body. To us, mind seems to be determined by the body because it is preoccupied with that and devoted to the physical workings which it uses for its conscious superficial action in the in this gross material world. So it's this encasement in the body which deepens the state of ignorance for the developing human consciousness. When he talks about us, there we are. Employing constantly that operation of the brain and nerves which it has developed in the course of its own development in the body, it is too absorbed in observing what this physical machinery gives to it to get back from it to its own pure workings. Those are to it mostly subconscious. So, as an evolving power of mind, emerging from its material encasement, it does not realize what its original mission was, what its actual power is. And he says it is mostly subconscious, which means that this power that the mind holds nascent within itself is there, but below the line of its active awareness. Still, we can conceive a life mind or life being which has got beyond the evolutionary necessity of this absorption and is able to see and even experience itself assuming body after body and not created separately in each body and ending with it. For it is only the physical impress of mind on matter, only the corporeal mentality that is so created, not the whole mental being. So this is mind as it is stationed in the power of life. And when he says assuming body after body, this means the whole power of mind in life to distribute itself at that level, at that plane of being. It's not talking here about life after life in the way that we would be thinking of rebirth. This is in the actual distribution of the oneness abroad, empowered with prana. To continue, this corporeal mentality is merely our surface of mind, merely the front which it presents to physical experience. Behind, even in our terrestrial being, there is this other, subconscious or subliminal to us, which knows itself as more than the body and is capable of a less materialized action. To this, we owe immediately most of the larger, deeper, and more forceful dynamic action of our surface mind. This, when we become conscious of it, or of its impress on us, is our first idea or our first realization of a soul or inner being, Purusha, perceived, as he notes, as the life being or vital being, Pranamaya Purusha. So this corporeal mentality is the mind fixed in the body. And the life that he's describing here is of mind stationed in the life. Less materialized, as he says. And if we can come into contact with that, it gives us a greater range of power and expressive action in the world. And of course, we can gain access to these greater currents of life energy and throw them into mentalized form through various agencies, including Tai Chi, Hatha Yoga, etc., but also the field of art, the field of music. And in these, our life powers are giving the mind greater regency. It isn't that life is absent mentality, but mind can work in life more freely than it does when it's encased in the physical consciousness, the corporeal mentality that he's described. But this life mentality also, though it may get free from the error of body, does not make us free from the whole error of mind. It is still subject to the original act of ignorance by which the individualized soul regards everything from its own standpoint and can see the truth of things only as they present themselves to it from outside, or else as they rise up to its view from its separate temporal and spatial consciousness, forms and results of past and present experience. It is not conscious of its other selves, except by the outward indications they give of their existence, indications of communicated thought, speech, action, result of actions, or subtler indications, not felt directly by the physical being, of vital impact and relation. So here again, this is mind distributing itself, but unaware of itself in other stations of selves. It is aware of the other only through indirection. We bump into them. We exchange thoughts. We speak to each other. And there may be others available, but none of them have that coin of authentic identity, which is the signature or the coin of the realm, in the realm of knowledge. So, pardon me, equally, he writes, is it ignorant of itself, for it knows of its self only through a movement in time and a succession of lives in which it has used its variously embodied energies. So again, it's identified with a moment in time, with a particular position and form in space, and of its individual station, not of all the others which are secretly its larger self. We are always wedded to the universe. We may not know it, but that is the secret truth of things. As our physical instrumental mind has the illusion of the body, so this subconscious dynamic mind has the illusion of life. In that, it is absorbed and concentrated, By that, it is limited. With that, it identifies its being. So this is the great weakness, suffering from the same separation which mind in body suffers, and which mind separated from its supramental connection suffers. So he writes this concluding sentence. Here, we do not yet get back to the meeting place of mind and supermind, and the point at which they originally separated. So you see, he's beginning to build a case for how it is that each of these stations of mind, mind encased in body, mind enmeshed in life, cannot tell us what is really possible, what is the true mission of mind functioning in the cosmos, and he will have to take us step by step above. So we've seen it fixed in the body, we've now seen it fixed in the pranamaya purusha, and we'll go forward. But there is still another, clearer, reflective mentality behind the dynamic and vital, which is capable of escaping from this absorption in life and views itself as assuming life and body in order to image out in active relations of energy that which it perceives in will and thought. It is the source of the pure thinker in us. It is that which knows mentality in itself and sees the world not in terms of life and body, but of mind. It is that, the mental being, Manomaya Purusha, which, when we get back to it, we sometimes mistake for the pure spirit, as we mistake the dynamic mind for the soul. Ah, that's an interesting connotation all by itself. But here, the pure mind, he says, opens us to the greater experience of unity. But this higher mind is able to perceive and deal with other souls as other forms of its pure self. It is capable of sensing them by pure mental impact and communication, and no longer only by vital and nervous impact and physical indication. It conceives, too, a mental figure of unity, and in its activity and its will, it can create and possess more directly, not only indirectly as in the ordinary physical life, and in other minds and lives as well as its own. So this is analogous to the way mind or consciousness is depicted in the Yoga Sutras of Patanjali, a mind freely capable of going beyond the limitations of senses, beyond the known instruments of contact, and knowing directly, just as Manas would be able to go without reliance on the lower senses, subtle and gross, and apprehend directly an object of knowledge and present it to the higher judgment for assessment. So, mind can act from a wider compass, freer, without suffering the limitations either of mind and life or of mind and body. But to continue, Sri Aurobindo then writes, but still, even this pure mentality does not escape from the original error of mind, for it is still its separate mental self, which it makes the judge, witness, and center of the universe, and through it alone strives to arrive at its own higher self and reality. All others are others, grouped to it around itself. When it wills to be free, it has to draw back from life and mind in order to disappear into the real unity, for there is still the veil created by avidya between the mental and supramental action. An image of the truth gets through, not the truth itself. So that same fundamental error, which is separation, that which divides, which not simply distinguishes so as to inform, but which actually allows an exclusive concentration of awareness and its power into a form. The sense of this mind being separate from the others cannot be got rid of. Simply through the action of the pure mind. The pure mind cannot separate that. When the pure mind wants to get back to the experience of spirit, of essence, it has to dissolve. It has to disappear into it. And of course, vide Shankara, vide many schools of Buddhism and Hinduism. That to solve this problem, one has to dissolve the drop back into the ocean and rid yourself of all idea of formation. Do you think Sri Aurobindo will be satisfied with that? No, he won't. This is not his position. And he continues, it is only when the veil is rent and the divided mind overpowered, silent, and passive to a supramental action that mind itself gets back to the truth of things. There. There we find a luminous mentality, reflective, obedient, and instrumental to the divine real idea. There we perceive what the world really is. We know in every way ourselves in others and as others, others as ourselves, and all as the universal and self-multiplied one. This takes us all the way back to the chapter on the pure existent. This takes us to his initial formulation of what is this supramental consciousness, as it takes the oneness of Satchitananda and distributes it harmoniously into the supramental creativity. This is the rending of the veil, which is necessary for the mind to gain access back to its original status in the supramental region. So he writes, we lose the rigidly separate individual standpoint, which is the source of all limitation and error. And you can underline that sentence. Still, we perceive also that all that the ignorance of mind took for the truth was in fact truth, but truth deflected, mistaken, and falsely conceived. We still perceive the division, the individualizing, the atomic creation, but we know them and ourselves for what they are, and we really are. So here its function is restored. The veil having been rent, one feels the oneness with all, feels them as oneself. The truth becomes available and part of a shared experience. And here Sri Aurobindo points to an integrative experience which is beyond the nirvana or the Brahmic absorption that he described in the previous paragraph, and which is his own experience. And why, in fact, he is writing about the life divine, not only as a potential, but as a future certainty. We still perceive the division, the individualizing, the atomic creation, but we know them and ourselves for what they are and we really are. It bears repeating. And so we perceive that the mind was really a subordinate action and instrumentation of the truth consciousness. As long as it is not separated in self-experience from the enveloping master consciousness, and does not try to set up house for itself, so long as it serves passively as an instrumentation and does not attempt to possess for its own benefit, mind fulfills luminously its function, which is in the truth, to hold forms apart from each other by a phenomenal, a purely formal delimitation of their activity, behind which the governing universality of the being remains conscious and untouched. So it's there to multiply. It's there to inform. It's there to pour force into. So it has a formative, distributive power, which works in concert with the supramental when it's in its right station. It has to receive the truth of things and distribute it according to the unerring perception of a supreme and universal eye and will. It has to uphold an individualization of active consciousness, delight, force, substance, which derives all its power, reality, and joy from an inalienable universality behind. It has to turn the multiplicity of the one into an apparent division by which relations are defined and held off against each other so as to meet again and join. It has to establish the delight of separation and contact in the midst of an eternal unity and intermissions. It has to enable the one to behave as if he were an individual dealing with other individuals, but always in his own unity. And this is what the world really is. So he's just given you an enumeration of powers of the functioning of the mind as it obeys, as it acts in dasya, not from an insight creating, but observing and measuring out the will and the idea as given to it. It receives, it upholds, it turns, it establishes, it enables, it does all of this in answer to the suzerainty of the supramental. And the world is really always this wonderful unity. The mind, he writes, is the final operation of the apprehending truth consciousness, which makes all this possible. And what we call the ignorance does not create a new thing, an absolute falsehood, but only misrepresents the truth. Now, this is good news because it means that however deep we might plunge into ignorance, self-ignoring what we are, that the original unity is always present and can always resume its full presentation. All we have to do is get rid of that sense of separation, because all ignorance is a misrepresentation. It is a compression of a whole into a part, a scene with one eye and not with all available eyes, a remembering only of one's own particular station and not of the all as it is stationed everywhere. He writes, "The ignorance is the mind separated in knowledge from its source of knowledge and giving a false rigidity and a mistaken appearance of opposition and conflict to the harmonious play of the supreme truth in its universal manifestation." So the rigidity that it believes in is false. That is elusive. But there is no fundamental illusion. What it sees is an aspect of the truth. And yet all it can do is reach out its hand to try to grasp the whole table and only place its hand on part of the table. The fundamental error of the mind is then this fall from self-knowledge by which the individual soul conceives of its individuality as a separate fact instead of as a form of oneness and makes itself the center of its own universe instead of knowing itself as one concentration of the universal. From that original error, all its particular ignorances and limitations are contingent results. Now, this is interesting. If you're familiar with the Semitic version of how it is that we lost the Garden of Eden, etc., there it's because somebody reaches up and goes for knowledge. And here it is a fall from self-knowledge, which leads to the division and the expulsion from delight, really. It's a self-banishment, nothing more. It is a focusing of our awareness on the particular and losing the whole, which is the root of our problem. From that original error, all its particular ignorances and limitations are contingent results. For viewing the flux of things only as it flows upon and through itself, it makes a limitation of being from which proceeds a limitation of consciousness and therefore of knowledge, a limitation of conscious force and will and therefore of power, a limitation of self-enjoyment and therefore of delight. So the mind perceiving things, separated from the supramental, sees this massive flux of the universe flowing only through itself, loses the allness of orientation, and then experiences, therefore, a limitation of Satchitananda. Mind becomes a limiting aperture through which all the reality has to pass as it comes into being, therefore distorting and separating the unity of what is real, sat, what is conscious, chit, what is powerful in presentation, tapas, and what is essentially delight at its root, ananda. It is conscious of things and knows them only as they present themselves to its individuality, and therefore it falls into an ignorance of the rest and thereby into an erroneous conception even of that which it seems to know. For since all being is interdependent, the knowledge either of the whole or of the essence is necessary for the right knowledge of the part. So we cannot know the part. We can't even know the particular if we don't know the all and if we don't know the essence. So here we are separated by knowledge. So you can't understand the individual unless you understand the universe, and if you understand that from which the universe comes. Hence, there is an element of error in all human knowledge. Similarly, our will, ignorant of the rest of the all will, must fall into error of working and a greater or less degree of incapacity and impotence. The soul's self-delight and delight of things, ignoring the all-bliss and by defect of will and knowledge unable to master its world, must fall into incapacity of possessive delight and therefore into suffering. Self-ignorance is therefore the root of all the perversity of our existence, and that perversity stands fortified in the self-limitation, the egoism which is the form taken by that self-ignorance. So egoism is the natural fruit of the self-dividing mind. And this self-separation, this ignoring of what our real self is, permits error in our knowledge, permits us or consigns us to an ignorance that at the highest level, anyone's action is undertaken in a secret or an overt alliance with an overarching will that expresses itself numberlessly through all points of individuation. So, the all bliss that is apparent in the vibration of the totality and the single thread of bliss which is available, connecting the individual to his act willed by the all, and therefore back to the ananda, which is the orchestration of the whole universe all of this is lost. Knowledge, will, delight all lapse because of this resistance, this embeddedness that mind takes in its own stance. Yet is all ignorance and all perversity, only the distortion of the truth and right of things, and not the play of an absolute falsehood. It is the result of mind viewing things in the division it makes, avidyayam antare, instead of viewing itself and its divisions as instrumentation and phenomenon of the play of the truth of Satchit Ananda. The Sanskrit there means within the ignorance, and actually refers all the way back to the Katha Upanishad 1, 2, 5, and the Mundaka Upanishad 1, 2, 8, if you want to go find those original citations. If it gets back to the truth from which it fell, it becomes again the final action of the truth consciousness in its apprehensive operation. And the relations it helps to create in that light and power will be relations of the truth and not of the perversity. So rending the veil, the mind can use the apprehensive power, which is nascent to it, to regain unity within the relations of the supramental. All that must be done is that that veil be cut. Rising from the pure mind to a higher level, we are capable of rending that veil and experiencing again the supramental play of consciousness. And then what we experience in the broad are relations of truth and not of a separation, which is a distortion, a perverse picture of what is really going on in the whole. They will be the straight things and not the crooked, to use the expressive distinction of the Vedic rishis. Truths, that is to say, of divine being with its self-possessive consciousness, will, and delight, moving harmoniously in itself. Now we have rather the warped and zigzag movement of mind and life, the contortions created by the struggle of the soul once grown oblivious of its true being to find itself again, to resolve back all error into the truth, which both our truth and our error, our right and our wrong, limit or distort, all incapacity into the strength, which both our power and our weakness are a struggle of force to grasp, all suffering into the delight, which both our joy and our pain are a convulsive effort of sensation to realize, all death into the immortality, to which both our life and our death are a constant effort of being to return. This, of course, bears comparison to that great chant in the Brihadaranyaka Upanishad at 1.3.28, in which we chant ourselves each evening when we gather, Asatoma Satgamaya. So, avidya results from the mind's exclusive standpoint and its identification through its power of separation, an ignorance which deepens when mind is encased in the body. But that lessens, that lifts a bit when mind developing rises to the level of a life mind. Still, there is a limitation, and it is possible for us to rise to the level of the pure mind, which gives us even greater sense of consanguinity with those other minds around us, but there is still that sense of centration, that sense of separation, which is the mark of ignorance, which limits even the pure mind from that perception of what it is. So, if that mind rising can separate, can rend that veil and restore itself in its ability to function as a vicegerent of the supramental, then it can reunify itself with the cosmos as a whole, experience the beauty and the wonder of the all reflected in each, and that not only it, but all others are equally true. All are empowered and all are expressive of a central divine will. And all experiences arise from and lead back to delight. This would be its experience if it could overcome that division. We could get rid of that veil which separates and sacrifices the oneness and the interdependence of the universal play and our experience of the essence which is behind the universe. So, we'll proceed farther. We'll take up chapter 19 in our next meeting. But I think we'll conclude with another section from Savitri. This is in the Book of Beginnings, the Yoga of the Soul's Release. Along a naked curve in bornless self, the points that run through the closed heart of things shadowed the indeterminable line that carries the everlasting through the years. The magician order of the cosmic mind, coercing the freedom of infinity with the stark array of nature's symbol facts and life's incessant signals of event, transmuted chance recurrences into laws, a chaos of signs into a universe. Out of the rich wonders and the intricate whorls of the spirit's dance with matter as its mask, the balance of the world's design grew clear, its symmetry of self-arranged effects, managed in the deep perspectives of the soul, and the realism of its elusive art, its logic of infinite intelligence, its magic of a changing eternity. So, thank you for attention. We appreciate you being with us. Namaste. Jai Ma.